got one Wednesday night on the bench on each side in the back, so be sure and pick one of those up so you'll have the handouts for the rest of the quarter. We're lesson 8 this morning. All right, we're in the life of Christ, getting started off, and now gotten into the ministry part. Jesus having been baptized by John, and now he's into the ministry part. And we'll pick up a little review from where we are Wednesday night and then get into this morning's lesson. Jesus is in Cana in Galilee. He attends a wedding feast. His mother and his brothers are there, along with his disciples. If you remember, they run out of wine, and Jesus' mother comes to him and says, you know, they run out of wine, and he's like, well, what does that have to do with me, type thing. And so she just tells the servants there, whatever he tells you to do, do it. So there are 6 large water pots there, probably used for some of the Jewish purification processes, and Jesus tells them to fill them up with water, fill them to the brim. And when they do, he says, dip some out in and take it to the master of the feast. And when they do, then it's wine. It's not just wine. It is the best wine they've had for the whole wedding feast there. This is a picture I found. This is an archaeological dig where they have uncovered right there in that very area. They make these pots like you'd be looking at here. Not the big pots like this, but the smaller versions of it. They haven't found the remains from the big pots. But anyhow, that's the same place here where they would actually make those ceramic type pots for this thing here. Now, some observations we made from this, that no way can you justify social drinking from looking at this episode, as some would try to do. Jesus used the term woman. Woman, what's this to me? And the same term he used when he was on the cross to tell John to take care of his mother. So we don't look at it as some, we might think of it as harsh. It's a woman, what's that got to do with me? Well, he didn't seem to be that way, because it's the same term used later on when it was starting to be a term of endearment there. And Jesus, this is his first miracle, and it begins to manifest his glory, show who he was, and it calls disciples to believe in him. Then they go down to Capernaum, over by the Sea of Galilee, on the north corner of it up there. And very short stay, nothing said about it really, just they went there. Then they go down to Jerusalem, or up to Jerusalem, the term, for the Passover, down on the map as we think about it, but up in elevation, to Jerusalem for the Passover. So Jesus is there, and he goes to the temple, and to his father's house. He finds those there doing business, as we would say. They were the money changers and those who would sell the animals for the sacrifices. And Jesus drove them out. He turned the tables over and he chastised them for making his father's house a house of merchandise. But the Jews didn't come in and say, okay, you know, wow, why are you doing all this? By what authority? What gives you the right to come in and do this type thing? And we want a sign, we want some kind of miracle or something to show that you got this authority, this power, this might. So he says, you tear this temple down, and I'll build it back in 3 days. That's the sign I'll give you. And they just got to come unglued, because it took 46 years. Herod's been working on his temple and restoring it and redoing it and rebuilding it, whatever. And you're going to do it in 3 days? So, of course, they did not believe that. But, of course, he was speaking of his body when he would die, buried back in 3 days. And then later on, when this happened, the disciples remembered back of what he had said here. They said many believe in Jerusalem because of the signs that he did there. Then he runs into, Nicodemus came to him. Nicodemus comes to him at night, and we talked about the speculation about why he would come at night. We don't know that. Nicodemus is a member, he's a Pharisee, a member of the Sanhedrin, and later on we see his other activities with Jesus and helping with the getting preparing for burial and things like this. But he recognized him as a man who came from God. No one can do the signs you do unless God be with him, he says. But Jesus tells him then, unless one's born again, he can't see the kingdom of God. Of course, Nicodemus didn't understand this. Would it be born again? Go back to your mother's womb and your grown man be born again. And so Jesus explains to him that one must be born of the water and the Spirit. And he talks to him and then explains the things to him and says, why are you a teacher of the law not understanding these things? Why did you not recognize some of these things? Then we talked about this verse, John 3:14. Jesus says, just as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. And go back to Numbers 29 and flip there with me right quick. I got two things I want to look at this morning. This is one of them. A point I didn't make well, which I don't want to hit here because we're going to use it again a little later on this morning. So Numbers 21. If you remember the story here, the Israelites are complaining and griping against Moses and God, and you brought us up here to die, this type thing. So God sends serpents among the people, and they bite them, and they die because of the fiery serpents. Verse 6. So, verse 7, they admit their sin. They've sinned, spoken against God. Pray to God, he'll take it away. So, verse 8. The Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent, set it on a pole, and when it shall be that everyone who is bitten shall live. So Moses made a bronze serpent, put it on a pole, so it was, if a serpent had bitten anyone, he lived. Now, yours read quite that way. You face anything with that? Anything I kind of messed up when I read that? Did you notice anything I messed up? Did I mess up on purpose, maybe? Okay. What did I leave out? In verse 8 and verse 9, both I left out something when I read that. I did on purpose. Verse 8. Anyone who is bitten, when he looks at it, shall live. Verse 9. Everyone who is bitten, when he looks at it, shall live. So, what I'm getting to, let's go down to this right here. This is the thing I had up here Wednesday night. Israel's salvation from the rebellion against God was the lifted up serpent on the pole. That's a true statement. But what did it take for them to live? They had to go look at the serpent. If they got bit, they would go look at the serpent that Moses lifted up on the pole in order to be saved from the snake bite. Now, second part, our salvation, and the point Jesus is making by using this example from the Old Testament, our salvation from rebellion against God is the lifted up Savior on the cross. True statement. What's missing from that statement? Well, the same thing is missing from the first one. There's something for us to do. Okay, I want to make sure we get that clear because there is something for them to do, and in the same parallel that Jesus is using, there's something for us to do. Now, hang on to that thought because we're going to use it down later on in the lesson this morning. That's why I want to spend a minute going through it. Okay. Yes. Yes, the poles and stuff, yeah. Right, later on it was just a pole or a stake in the ground. Okay, then we talked about God so loved the world. The famous verse in John 3:16, how much or what mode or how did God love the world? Well, enough he would send his only son in order to save us. He didn't send Jesus to condemn the world. Not what he came for. He came for salvation, to save the world. Condemnation came because men love the darkness rather than the light, because their deeds were evil, and we spent some time talking about then the difference between evil and good, and those who call good evil and call evil good, and we got why do people get so mixed up, why they can't figure out what's good and what's evil, and then we said, well, why can't we figure it out sometime? Well, we call evil good and good evil because I want to do this, therefore I call it good. Type thing. So what is the real thing? Well, it's the truth. Jesus said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. Verse 21 says, he who does the truth comes to the life. And so that's what we need to do. Let our light shine with that. Okay, quick summary of what we did Wednesday night. This morning we'll be in John chapter 3. We'll start in verse 22 and get most of John chapter 4. One little jump off to Matthew which we'll talk about very briefly. All right, so John 3, starting in verse 22. All right, Jesus is down in Judea. We talked about him being down there when he went to the Passover. We went in and cleansed the temple. Back in chapter 2, it references that, where he went down there. Then our first verse we got in the text today is, after these things, which would be after the Nicodemus conversation, that Jesus' disciples came to the land of Judea. So they're out in the countryside now, down in Judea, and was there with them, and he baptized. So Jesus is baptizing. Looks like John was baptizing. Which brings up a point that we have some time off, we'll get into sometime, is that is, what's the difference between John's baptism and Jesus' baptism at this point in time? Not after the death, but at this point in time. We'll talk about this. We have some time sometime. So John's disciples get concerned because his disciples are having more followers than what John is. Jesus' disciples are baptizing more than John's disciples are. So John's disciples get upset about that and come talking about it. So John has to remind them, okay, of why he came, what his purpose was. He uses the bridegroom example. He says, I'm not the bridegroom. I'm a friend of the bridegroom. The bridegroom is the one that's going to get the honor and the glory at a wedding. I'm just a friend of the bridegroom, he says. We've already talked about why John came. I'm not the Christ. We tell him that repeatedly. I am not the Christ. I was sent before him to prepare his way. That's why I'm here. That was my purpose. And so he says in verse 30 here that he will increase and I will decrease. And that time has come because Jesus is now in his ministry. So it's time now for John to start backing off as far as the public scene is concerned. And Jesus will increase. And John recognizes that. And the question is, how did John understand his role? What's going to happen when Jesus begins his ministry? How's John going to take that? And I made the statement when we started this quarter, I'm thrilled to be in here teaching while I have the physical and the mental ability to do it. But I know a time is coming when I can't do that. And elders and preachers and teachers and everybody has to recognize there's a point for us to back off, that it's time for us to go do what we can do. We can't do the things we used to do. And one writer I was reading kind of used that this thing to illustrate that. John, there's a time for John to back down. He said, Jesus is going to increase and I'm going to decrease. That's what he's telling his disciples here. So John's role is that of a decrease now at this point. Now the last verse in chapter 3, verse 36, spend just a minute looking at it. I want to compare this one with John 3:16, one we're all familiar with. This verse says, he who believes in the Son has everlasting life. This is in New King James. And he who does not believe the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God abides in him. Now if you take that same verse from some different translations, Revised Standard and the English Standard, or two I know, changes a word in there, and that word is obey. Whoever believes the Son has eternal life, which is the same as the way in the other translation. But this one says, whoever does not obey the Son does not see life. But the other one said, who does not believe in the Son. So one's got believe and one's got obey. So my good question I'm thinking about here is, those who would use John 3:16, where it says, God so loved the world, sent his only begotten Son, whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life, and use that for a faith-only type doctrine. So how does this verse then, if you put in the word obey in here, how's it tie in with that? Go to the other place I want you to go this morning. Go to Hebrews chapter 3 right quick. Hebrews chapter 3. When I read about this difference in the words here, the place I was reading, they tried to explain the Greek differences and whatever, so I came up and talked to my Greek expert, Steve, and he had studied this word before. The word that's used for obey, it does not obey in the Revised Standard and English Standard here. It's used 16 times, Steve said, in the New Testament. And about half of those times is translated disobedience or does not obey. And other times, disbelief or unbelief. So it's a word that can be used, if you actually look at the definition, can be used either way. And it's used here in Hebrews chapter 3 in verse 18. And this is about the Israelites coming in and entering the rest that they were promised. And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest but those who did not obey? Same word here we got for the obey here. So I'm trying to tie obedience and disbelief together. So read verse 19. They said, those who did not enter the rest is those who did not obey. So we see then they could not enter because of what? Unbelief. Okay. Again, a linking of unbelief with not obeying. If I don't believe, what am I not going to do? If I don't believe that serpent is going to heal me, looking at that serpent on the pole up there, if I don't believe it's going to heal me, what am I not going to do? I'm not going to go look at it, right? Why would I? I have no faith in the fact that it's going to heal me. So why go look at it? So I have no reason for my actions if I don't have belief. If I believe the serpent will heal me, I'll go look at it and I'll be healed. If I don't believe it, I won't go to the action. So linking belief or disbelief with the lack of obedience. I think that's what it's doing, the same thing here. That's why I can use the word, it could be translated according to Steve, either direction, and it is different places here. He that believes in the Son has everlasting life. Who does not believe in the Son won't obey the Son. If you don't believe, you're not going to obey Him. So therefore, you're going to have eternal destruction. Okay. Any more comments on that? Have I got everybody all confused and messed up? Yes, it's where Brent. I heard his voice. You know where he was. Yes. Yeah. If you believe what Moses said to do, you're going to be saved, right? Well, what you have to do to believe what you believe what Moses said, then you're going to do what Moses told you to do, right? So you believe Christ can save you, you're going to do what Christ told you to do. And that's why I'm putting the parallel back out earlier. Okay. Moving now to John chapter 4. That's the end of 3. In chapter 4, Pharisees heard Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John. It says, though Jesus himself did not baptize any, but his disciples did. So this is getting the attention of the Pharisees because of this. So Jesus now leaves Judea and goes back to Galilee, which is, of course, where he's going to spend the bulk of his time with his ministries in Galilee. But he'd been down for the feast. Now, we're going to insert here. This is coming out of Matthew chapter 14. We're going to insert this little piece here. And the story just because kind of fits in right here because of John. We looked at a chart of Herod's family before, and we'll look at it again. It's on the next slide here. Herod Antipas, son of Herod the Great, okay, he's a tetrarch of Galilee. Herod had married Herodias. Now, she was really the wife of Herod's brother Philip when Herod Antipas married her. So John had told her, just outright told her, it's not lawful for you to have her. You can't have her. She's married to your brother. And so Herod put John in prison because of it. That's the only point we're getting out of this piece right here, is that John is now in prison because Herod's done this. Now look at the chart, if it helps you get it in mind better. Here's Herod and Philip, and he was married to Herodias, which is really his niece. Okay, the whole thing is complicated. Now, I told you before when we looked at this chart, some charts only have one Philip instead of Herod, Philip, and Philip. Some only have one, and it makes it clearer at this point here who Herodias is married to if you only have one Philip to deal with. But others will break it out and have two Philips again because they think it's two different wives of Herod up here. But in any case, Herodias is married to Herod, and then Herod Antipas came in and married her. And that's what John told her. It's lawful for you to have her. She's married. And then Herod put John in prison. So just that little sideline point there stuck in here. Now, Jesus is going back from Judea to Galilee. And he travels through Samaria, which would not be the necessary usual route they might go. Go back up through the Jordan, across the Jordan, and back up through Perea and up the east side of the Jordan. But Jesus goes back through Samaria when he goes up from Jerusalem, going back to Galilee. So Jerusalem, this map here, is of course down at the bottom down here, top of the Dead Sea. And he's going back up through the hill country to this area right here. So let's zoom in a little bit. So we got up here is Jacob's Well. Here's Sychar. And obviously this Shechem will be there. And we'll look at this closer just in a minute. We'll get closer there. But the woman at the well there. All right. In fact, here is a picture that Trent Rebecca one took. On which one? I guess, of the hill country of Samaria. That's what it would look like in that area where we are here, around this part. So, going through Samaria, what does that mean? Well, you got to remember, the Jews and Samaritans are like oil and water. They don't mix. They have nothing to do with them. It goes back to the time of the captivity when people were brought in, from foreigners brought in, and got mixed in with the Abraham blood line, if you will, there. So there's a mixed people here and replaced by foreigners. But Jesus says in verse 4, he needed to go through Samaria. Now, exactly why he said, I need to go through Samaria, I don't know if he was going to teach that woman there or what it was, but he needed to go that direction instead of going around. So they got to the well here, Jacob's Well, and the disciples go into town to buy food. So Jesus is there, and a woman comes out to draw water. So he asks her for a drink, which would be, for us, a very logical type thing to do. He's been traveling on a journey, weary, hot, maybe thirsty. So he asks her for a drink. And they get this conversation about water. And if you're a teacher, John chapter 4 is a great chapter to look at. So I say, teacher training chapter, if you will. Look at the way Jesus handles this woman at the well. What's he going to start out with here? He's going to do a contrast between physical water and the living water and get her to understand the difference between one and the other. Later on, he's just going to tell her some outright facts when he says, I'm the Messiah. And then other things he goes through here as he uses different teaching techniques to approach them and talk to her and correct this totally false concept about worship, which we'll get to just in a minute. But read this chapter sometime, look at it from a teaching perspective, how Jesus taught her. So she said, I'd like to have some of this living water. And what's her thought? Well, she has to come out every day. And I don't know how physically far it was from the well into the city, but she had to come out, even if it's a quarter of a mile. I mean, big deal. What do? We turn on the tap, and there it is, right? So she had to come out every day and go draw water. This physical act of drawing water for the animals, for any purpose they're going to use water for. She had to go out every day and draw this water. And so if you give me living water that you'll never thirst again, I want it. So she's still thinking about the physical water, the dread of having to come out every day and draw this water. So he's going to turn around a little bit now. So he says, go call your husband. And she says, I don't have a husband. And Jesus says, you're right. Because the man you're living with now is not your husband. But you have five other ones already. Well, if you're sitting there talking to this total stranger and he tells you that, what do you immediately think? Somebody special. I mean, how does he know about me? How does he know about my life and my five husbands and who I'm living with now and all this kind of stuff? So she said, I perceive you must be some kind of prophet. She didn't know him, but obviously he had some kind of power. So she says, I don't know if she's doing this because she really wanted to know about worship or she's changing the subject. Because he just asked her, what? About her husband. Let's go get your husband. I don't have one. you're married to one you shouldn't be married to, and at five, so she's going to change the subject. She said, well, let me ask you about worship since you're a prophet. Or maybe she really wanted to know about the worship. But whichever the case, she asked about worship. So back to our map here. Here's where we are. Here's the well. This is the city of Sychar where they were. So she said, here's Mount Gerizim, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, about 3,000, almost 3,000 feet high. So she asked a question, and she says, where should we worship? We worship here in these mountains, and you worship in Jerusalem. Now, which place is right? And Jesus said, well, the time's coming when neither in these mountains nor in Jerusalem will you worship God. Okay. In fact, he says, the time is coming, and now it is, the way he puts it. But he says, God's a spirit. Those who worship him in spirit and truth. So he's telling her a whole different concept of worship from what she's ever thought of, ever heard of. Now, a little side note. Samaritans had a temple there in Mount Gerizim. It was destroyed in 129 B.C., or 128 B.C., several years before this. And think about the Jewish temple. It's going to be destroyed in AD 70. So the two places that they worshiped then would both be destroyed soon. And the whole point is the physical place to worship is becoming irrelevant. That's not the point. So it's not in these mountains or in Jerusalem where you're going to worship. It's not the where. It's the how. Spiritual nature of the new kingdom. Entirely different. God's a spirit. Those that worship him in spirit and in truth. Where we assemble now doesn't matter. That's what we're doing with our worship. It's the attitude. It's our heart. And like even today, are we truly worshiping God? We're here to worship. So she was looking for the Messiah. She said, we know the Messiah is coming, which maybe more we say from some of the people Jesus is going to deal with in this ministry here. Jesus just flat comes out and says, that's me. I'm him. You're looking for the Messiah? I'm him. That kind of got her attention. So she goes back then and tells the others in the city. Say, come see this man. They tell me everything I ever did. Could it be the Messiah? So they come out now, and Jesus teaches them. And they believe. First because of what the woman said, and then they believe because of what Christ had said to them and how he taught them. What they did. So we're probably going through just a few minutes early this morning. But let's look at a couple of thoughts from these last two or three verses here. Verse 32. He said to them, I have food to eat you don't know of. It's speaking to disciples when they went into town and came back with food, and Jesus says, yeah, I'm not hungry, I'm not looking for that physical food. I got food to eat that you don't know about. What's he talking about? What's he talking about? The food he had to eat that they don't know about. Then he says, here it is. My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to do his work. That's my food. What does food do for us? It's our life. It's what we depend on. What does Jesus want to do? Think about it. Let's see. Let's look at verse 35. We'll go back and look at 34 again in a minute. 35 says, do not say there's several months of the harvest, 4 months of the harvest, but the harvest is there now. The field is already white to harvest. Now around here, that always something that really resonates with us. About this time of year, the cotton fields, the field gets put out, and the cotton fields turn white. Can certainly recognize the fields being white to harvest. Of course, Jesus is talking about a different kind of harvest. So we'll come back to this picture here in just a minute and talk about it. Let's go back now to 32. What's this food he's going to eat of? I've been eating food that James thought about. Their minds were on the physical food. They've been on a journey. They needed nourishment. So what was the food he wanted there? His thoughts are on spiritual matters, because he'd been talking to the woman here too well. He said, my food is to do the will of him who sent me, by his do his work. This is the thing I wanted to look at. I read across this little saying, or piece here. A food to the hungry and water to the thirsty. Now stop a minute. What is food to the hungry? How many of us have ever been hungry? I mean, hungry because we haven't eaten in 2 or 3 days or something. I mean, hungry like some of the letters we get from the guys in Zim with have no food. Hungry. What is food to a person like that? How many of us have been thirsty? I mean, to the point of needing water. And what is water to a person like that? Now, it's food to this to the hungry, and water is to the thirsty. So is doing the will of God to those who love him. Can we make the comparison here? What is food to a person who is really, really hungry? What is water to a person who's really, really thirsty? What is doing God's will like to those who really, really love him? He goes on to say, whether it's sowing the spiritual seed or whether it's reaping the harvest from someone else's sown, it doesn't matter. My work is my greatest joy, doing that. So let's think about comparing the hungry, food and water, and being thirsty, and compare that to our love for God and doing his will and doing his work. That's kind of what Jesus was doing. My will, my work is to do the work of him who sent me. Then he goes to verse 35 and says, don't say there's 4 months to the harvest. The harvest is there now. It's there. Go look at it. So what's the lessons? The lesson we get from these verses, I think. How much good did Jesus do by talking to this one woman at the well? Who came out to him? Right. Because of her and what she understood, she went back and told those in the city. They came out, he taught her. And so, who knows how much good we will do from talking to one person? We don't know that. Conversation with the woman resulted in deep interest felt throughout the city and the conversion of many of those to God. He brought the conversation up, give me a drink of water. And they went into a religious discussion. He showed her who he was. And she went back to the city, and they came out, and many believed because of it. But look at this thing here, too. What did it take for him to speak to her? What kind of boundary did he break? She was a Samaritan. That was a no-no. She was a female. That, in the Jewish class here, would have been not something that a normal man would stop and talk to. She'd be a social outcast as far as he's concerned, as far as the normal Jews is concerned. For him, a Jew, to speak to her, a Samaritan woman. But he broke that boundary. He broke that boundary. And he taught her and taught others. So now I come back. Who have I talked to recently? As you think about that, who have I talked to recently? Why don't you look at these faces? There are faces up here of black people and white people. And I think there's an Asian on the very front row or an Oriental of some kind. It doesn't matter. They're all faces. There's long hair, and there's short hair, there's curly hair, and there's kinky hair, and there's no hair. But they're all looking right toward us, looking right at us. Which one of them should I be speaking to? Yeah. On the physical side there, he presents they're all spirit, they're all got a soul, isn't it? the bottom line. Okay. And maybe there's one of them is waiting for me to come and talk to him. So who am I spoken to recently? What good would it do if I break a barrier of some kind and speak to one person? What might come out of it? Okay. About 3 minutes early. Anybody else got thoughts, comments? Anybody? Jeff? Sure.
One is just a textual observation. Someone mentioned this to me years ago. When Jesus says in verse 35, lift up your eyes and look on the fields, it's entirely possible that we can connect that to verse 40. He saw the Samaritans coming to him. He says, here comes the way. I don't know how much time elapsed.
Well, the people that see it coming, because people see it coming out. That's, if I can use a very close to us personal example, it's exactly what Hannah did with Ben. Hannah called me one night and said, my friend Ben wants to talk to one of the elders. He wants somebody to help him understand some things. So Hannah was not in a position necessarily to teach him that, but she got him and she brought him here. That's a very close to us example that we all sure relate to. Before they start digging out for themselves. Yeah. You get the introduction there, get the basics there, and then if they're hungry, like we talked about earlier, if they're thirsty like we talked about earlier, and they start digging out, then they're going to learn and absorb and understand and believe more and more because of their own study. Okay, anything else? We got about half a minute, that's it. Yes, sir. That's right. If you invite somebody to come, be sure you're going to be here. Bad, they come looking for you. All right. Thank you very much.